This is tape two. We're talking with Dr. Richard Sullivan. At the time of the ending of the last tape, we were discussing the beginnings of the Michigan Humanities Council. The Humanities Council was an important outreach effort of your of you, and you saw that, and that continues to today.
Yes, uh-huh.
See, this was really not a university thing. That's not the way the government looked at it. It wanted to get people other than, although it needed university people to play the role of humanists and to really to organize the thing. But it was really intended to bring the money to public people in the public who could come up with projects that might be humanistically oriented in some way or another. And so that in that sense, it was not a university outreach, but it was in terms of putting the humanities in a position of some visibility, it was a great thing for us.
Now, when you mentioned government, were you talking about state government,
federal government. The Michigan Council for the Humanities, as was were all the state councils, every state had, eventually had one of them. Mm-hmm. They were funded by the federal government.
Was that through the National Endowment for the Humanities,
yes,
or that was all part of that?
Yes, yeah, it was part
program.
Of the National, it was one of the programs of the National Endowment.
Okay, and then do you remember what year it was that started?
I hate to have to... It was sometime during the 70s.
During the 70s, okay. We can always look up the date.
In fact, I think it was rather early on, but I just don't remember the exact date.
So this was a major area of cooperation between you and the University of Michigan, the dean there?
Yes.
Was there anyone else that was involved in that?
Well, there was a dean from Wayne State.
Wayne State?
Yes. And then there was a public representative from the labor unions.
Okay. That's right. You mentioned that. Okay.
And I can't remember her name. But it was the three universities, and we were the ones who
AFL-CIO.
Got the first grant, yes. Mm-hmm. But then the requirement of the grant was, of course, to set up a Michigan Council for the Humanities, an independent entity outside the sphere of any university.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
John Cantlin was good enough, and the College of Arts and Letters, to provide, at least in the beginning, a place for the Humanities Council to roost, so to speak. It was on the campus, although it rented space, the council rented space, but still the university supported it. Mm-hmm. But it was not a university function.
I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you must have chosen well, because
Ron Means was here. Yeah, he was here
for most of the time, and I think got to be
recognized in the long run as a really one of the outstanding heads of local council, state councils. Did you know him?
Yes, not as a student. I was involved in the Michigan Oral History Association.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we got one grant from them to do an oral history project.
Yeah, yeah.
And then also Sheldon Hackney, when he was head of the National Endowment for the Humanities, invited us to Wayne State, and I was, through my oral history role, I sat next to him and talked with him about some projects that we were involved in, and so that's how I knew him only briefly before he retired.
Yeah.
In that.
Was that the time he came to the Ford Museum? No.
In my case, the Detroit Historical Museum had just celebrated an opening of the they had a whole moving assembly line from the Cadillac plant. And he was there dedicating that because the National Endowment supported that. And then I was in charge of an oral history project that related to workers. And the Michigan Council was involved that time.
Yeah.
But so that's how I first met him, but right at that time. But he was supportive of oral history and saw that as an important outreach and to getting general public involved in scholarly study and historical study. Besides the Michigan Humanities Council, anything in terms of East Lansing that you were involved on? Were you asked to be speakers or anything like that?
I also became a member of the College of Arts and Letters Dean's Community Council. When John Eadie became dean, one of the first things he did was to draw together a group of people from the community to work with the college, to promote the college's interest in the community and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I was ultimately or eventually appointed a member of that council and still am on it. And so I've been involved in that kind of thing. I would have to define myself as not much of an organization person. I have always been very active in national history organizations too, so that's been part
well,
of my...
Well, right. Could you talk a little bit about those, your role in some of the national groups? You obviously presented.
Oh, yes, you know? Yes. I've been an officer. I was, of course, an American Historical Association, although I presented papers there, but I was never really involved in that. But the Medieval Academy, which is the organization that embraces my discipline, I've been much involved in that for many years. I was on its council and ultimately got to be elected a fellow of the Academy, which is, there are 100 people from roughly, well, about 90 people from the whole Canada and the United States medievalists who are chosen somewhere along their career for this. And that involves, you know, being a kind of spokesperson for the Academy, being involved in its activities. I suppose the greatest involvement was that I was really the person who took the leadership in founding a regional association of medievalists called the Midwest Medieval Conference, which meets every year and focuses attention on historians from really kind of the Big Ten territory. It extends a little beyond that, but that's mostly where it comes from. And we try to bring in medievalists not only from, bring together medievalists not only from the big universities in this area, but also the smaller schools where people don't have as much opportunity to participate in learned scholarly activities and so forth. And so that's taken up a lot of my time over the years.
Where was that centered? Was there any university that became centered?
No, it meets from university to university every year, a different one. It's met here twice and over the years.
So it rotates around the Midwest?
Yes, around the Midwest, and we go from one place to another. But to keep that going has been something that's taken up some of my time.
Mm-hmm. The whole issue of regionalism seems to be an important one.
Yeah.
And did you face criticism by people who?
Well,
yeah. Or was there were there any issues there?
This was a kind of thing that I don't like to talk too much about it, but it really was true. The Medieval Academy really started out and remained for a long time a kind of East Coast establishment. You know, the Fertile Crescent from the Widener Library to Princeton Inn. That was it. And people from elsewhere, except for rare occasion of a West Coaster, didn't get much time with the Medieval Academy. So in a sense, this started out as a kind of, you know, the hell with you sort of thing. We'll do our own thing if you won't have anything to do with us. Well, the Medieval Academy has changed since, and partly because of this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
We were the first of the regional associations to get in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon the Medieval Academy was meeting out here in the Midwest, you know, and things of that kind.
Well, culture beyond the Hudson.
That's right.
So you face that in the academic sense. You mentioned before about the Wharton Center. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in that? That was in the 1980s, or was that early? Dr. Wharton had left, and then...
No, it started before he...
While he was here,
even
though it wasn't named the Wharton.
Yes, that's why.
But he was a driving force behind some of the
initial
planning.
See, at that time, the lecture concert series, as it was then called, was in the College of Arts and Letters. It was part of under the umbrella of the College of Arts and Letters. Since that program was directly interested in having a better facility to take the place of the auditorium, naturally as the head of that, I was drawn into the planning and the discussion and so forth for the Wharton Center. So from the very beginning, I was involved in that as part of the planning committee and on and on and on. That was a long, drawn-out affair, and especially getting the money for it. And
mm-hmm. What were you involved in the money, getting the money?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although primarily, that's not one of my great strengths, raising money. But they hired, you know, a professional money raiser, and I worked very closely with him. Mm-hmm. He knew how to do this, and I could help him. So that's how I was involved in it primarily.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I went around and talked to people, and
so you were at the, and you were at the dedication?
Oh yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
What first time you walked into the Great Hall? What do you remember?
Well, I had been walking into it for a couple of years while it was being built, you know. So
it wasn't so end.
But it was a great moment in my life. I will have to admit that, and, and I think a great moment in this university's history. I still think it was a it's a feather in this university's cap that only slowly are people beginning to realize it. You know, when we get crowds in here night after night, week after week, to fill that place, it's really something. And I'm not sure it can match the basketball team all the time.
They're playing tonight.
Yeah, that's right.
But it seems to me to be important in both areas.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about the Wharton Center was that it met a good bit of opposition within the university, because lots of people wanted to build what the Breslin Center, something like what the Breslin Center is, an all-purpose facility, you know, mm-hmm. where you play basketball and have concerts. And it was just ridiculous to think that we, you know, we already had one of those kind of places in the auditorium. Mm-hmm. It was just ridiculous to think that we should spend X millions of dollars and just that, only that, because mm-hmm. you couldn't have many kinds of artistic performances that just don't work in places like Breslin Center. And mm-hmm.
So that was
a big battle mm-hmm. at the time. Yeah.
And so there was pressure at the time then to just simply remodel or redo the auditorium versus facility?
There was pressure to do nothing.
Oh.
to build a Breslin Center or something like that. That's what the pressure was for. Mm-hmm. To build another auditorium, all purpose, except that this would be athletics as well as, you know, tractor pulls and mm-hmm. string quartets, all that would go in the same same building.
The circus too. Interesting when you think about it.
And that's where Wharton really stood his ground. And mm-hmm.
Do you see that as a
And you can imagine that there would be a lot of people in the public domain who would think that would be a good thing too, who, you know, weren't used to going to concerts or interested in going to concerts. Mm-hmm.
Would you say that in terms of what the Wharton Center offers today, that it met its potential, or what you as an initial planner or person involved, would you feel?
I sometimes get a little impatient that perhaps the Wharton Center is a little bit too commercialized now, but you know, I know that it has to keep the doors open and the heat bill paid and so forth, so I'm realistic enough to know that, you know, you have to have a lot of things that draw a lot of people, or you can't keep a place like that open.
Right. I know that was a controversy when Les Mis first came.
Yes,
that,
yeah.
That the place Ralph Vodopek couldn't play there because Les Mis staging was there.
I have concerns about that, but still I think on the whole that we get a huge variety of programs that are quality programs, and taken together they do the university, they do the university's name well. They really do, I think.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever involved in international outreach at all? Not counting your international travel or anything like that, or scholarship.
Well,
were you involved in any international programs that the university had?
The truth was that the College of Arts and Letters really had the first overseas programs. Nobody recognized. Everybody's taking credit now for inventing this, you know, like Al Gore and the computer. All of a sudden, everybody's taking credit for it. Mm-hmm. But we had study programs abroad for years before the university took it up as a real mission. And I used to visit those places periodically, and mm-hmm. In Germany and in France and in Spain and Italy.
And so it was language,
but language-oriented?
But
culture, too. It got to be things, culture. We began to expand on it. It started out as language programs, but they began to tack on and cultural. Mm-hmm. You know, students could go to Freiburg in Germany and really get a year's worth of academic programs besides German. And,
were you involved in setting up any of those exchange programs, either with faculty
during your tenure?
Are there any ones that you remember that you actually did? Or but you mentioned Freiburg.
Well, we had a program at Freiburg, yes.
Right, okay.
Oh, we had some people come here as visiting professors that mm-hmm. were very interesting. Dennis, I can't remember his name right now. Mm-hmm. An Englishman who came in the history department was, God, I can't remember his name. Anyway, quite a character.
We can drink it. Yes, yeah.
And there were several visiting professors while I was dean, as mm-hmm. there have been since. And, mm-hmm.
In looking at your own background, you mentioned how important the study of Latin was, and obviously mm-hmm. determining your yeah. end career. How about the classical languages here at Michigan State during the time you were...
Well, languages had a tough time of it while I was dean, because students were rebelling against all requirements. Mm-hmm. The language requirement was one they rebelled against most, you know, because to most of them it didn't seem to have any particular value. So... a good part of the university gave up a language requirement while I was dean, which didn't do the language departments any good because it really took their bread and butter away from them. So mm-hmm. that was a major problem for us. And, survived, and in fact, the study of languages has come back very nicely now on a much more realistic basis, I think, than requirements and all of that stuff. And the language was offered a very difficult... Language instruction offered a very difficult problem from an administrator's point of view. Almost no one in French or German or Spanish wanted to teach the beginning languages. Mm-hmm. They wanted to teach literature.
And of so the
it
language.
Ended up, yeah, so mm-hmm. it ended up that language was being taught by graduate assistants who were learning the language, you know, and it was not a very happy arrangement.
One chapter ahead.
Yes, one chapter ahead, if that.
And, yeah.
Even the graduate students were thinking about becoming literature professors, so they weren't even interested in teaching the languages. Mm-hmm. So there was always that terrible problem of what students thought was bad instruction, and I must admit it was bad instruction sometimes. Mm-hmm. Not that the graduate students are no good, but they just did not yet have the skills to do what, that's a tough job to teach a foreign language, you know, mm-hmm. that's not
Absolutely.
Easy, and, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did you, the new push of the university toward international study abroad, what do you think about that? Does that fit into
I'm
your...
I'm all in favor of it, yes. Yeah. I hope it doesn't become kind of routinized and thus not very valuable. Mm-hmm. If you get too many Native Americans in one place, abroad, they're going to end up not learning anything about being abroad. They're mm-hmm. going to live with themselves. And,
not part of the culture.
Not part right. of the culture. So mm-hmm. I'm fearful that the programs will get out of hand in that respect. There'll be too many American students, MSU students, concentrated in one place mm-hmm. for their own good. And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, the students almost ought to go alone abroad, I think.
Yeah. And, so you see it as numbers is not necessarily, large numbers are not necessarily,
not necessarily better. Now, you know, the students can't go abroad without getting something out of it, no matter
of
what.
Of course.
But not as much as if they start hanging around only with each other, then it's not going to work very well, I don't think.
Yeah. And it seems to me, too, the key is the involvement of faculty in that overseas yeah. study and encouragement. Yeah.
Is that occurring much now?
I think it's more or less a faculty member can develop a program, and so that's encouraged, but we're not given development money
to
do
it's,
that.
It's so. Not really yet a priority.
Not quite.
In terms
yeah.
of,
it is from the student side,
yeah,
and
yeah,
then
yeah.
It,
yes.
it's more or less an interdisciplinary and mm-hmm. outside of College of Arts and Letters,
yeah.
perhaps, but perhaps our new dean will... That'll be different, perhaps, I think. If we talk about some staff members, lots of times in the part of the university, we talk about faculty, we talk about students, presidents, provosts. Mm-hmm. Some of the everyday staff members, in terms of actually running, who were some staff members that you worked with that you recall that maybe were important in your work?
Well, I had a remarkable series of secretaries over the years. Sandy Cuthbertson in the history department, and
when you were chair?
Chair. Ethel mm-hmm. McWinney is dean secretary. Joyce Hardy in the provost's office. Barb, what was her name? Well, anyway, I think Michigan State's been very lucky in its secretarial staff. I think they're really dedicated people who do their job very well, and sometimes they have more commitment than some of the people they're working for. And,
yeah. Interesting approach.
I've always admired the staff of the library for doing great things with the least amount of resources that I think any library in the Big Ten has. I've always been amazed at the ability of people like Dick Chapin, those who manage the hordes of students who work in the library and somehow get the work done. I've always thought of that as the best run place in the whole university.
You mentioned going back to the library and the tremendous change in your field. Mm-hmm. Were there any librarians that or bibliographers that expanded the program or expanded the collections in the medieval area?
Yeah, I suppose Henry Coke was. He was a kind of acquisitions librarian with interest in history and old-time history even. So he was always very open to suggestions for purchasing books and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the central administration finally came around to seeing the importance of a library. For example, I was a head of a university committee that really planned the addition to the library. We had to go to the state legislature to get money for it. John Hanna got into that in a big way, and of course it wouldn't have happened had he not, but...
It's part of the transition from college to major university. Importance of a library.
As I said, when I first came here, the library was in what the museum is now,
within the same building.
Mm-hmm. You could imagine how many books you could get in there.
Are there any specific resources that were, while you were either in the history department or... as dean in your specific area of medieval history that we acquired that you can say? Not to give a card catalog, but are there any successes that where a student studying medieval history at Michigan State now has got those resources because of your work?
Well, you know, there's the work of several of us, in fact. Okay. We bought at rather considerable expense collections of printed medieval documents. They're, you know, they were mostly compiled in the 19th century, the great age of editing and publishing source material of all kinds. Mm-hmm. And we bought one after another of those kinds of collections, and the library is full of them. Our remote storage is full of them more often than not.
So you have to wait a little bit before you get actually get it.
The most difficult thing, and the thing that has not been kept up as well as I'd like, but I understand why, we convinced the library to begin to invest in scholarly productions, many of them in foreign languages that have to do with ancient and medieval European history in general, and ultimately in Asian and African history. A lot of periodicals, which is a very expensive item, and it's got more expensive through the years. We haven't kept up as well as that as we should. A lot of them have been canceled in the last few years for financial reasons, and partly, I think, to pay for new kinds of technology. I don't have any doubts about the fact that they don't give computers away. And, but the library was really... And I'm not the only one. You could ask 20 people in the English department as well as 20 people in the history department who are old-timers, if you could get them together, they would all agree that that was kind of a miracle what happened in the library during the years.
So you credit Dick Chapin with
a good bit of the credit, yes. Mm-hmm. Not only did he run a good library, but he was able to persuade people who made critical decisions about what the money went for, that it was important to have a library.
As you look back on your entire career here and how the university has changed, what are your thoughts on Michigan State University now in the 21st century?
Well, it's I think it, as I said before, I think it has some very serious decisions ahead of it about what it's going to do with itself. I have a feeling that it's been drifting the last few years in terms of any kind of focus. I don't think that it's going to be able to continue that. I think it's going to have to decide on doing certain things. I hope it doesn't decide to just become a service institution that is totally oriented toward doing whatever society wants it to do. I understand that's important. I wouldn't for a moment knock that, but I do think a university has to be independent in one sense of the word. It has to insist that there must be new knowledge. That new knowledge must be sought out, even if it doesn't pay off. That's the responsibility of the university, if it's going to call itself that. Now, you could be something else and call yourself a university, but that's what I think the decision has to be. What is it that we are going to put our resources into? You know, I don't think we have any business having 3 medical schools here. Mm-hmm. I really don't think that's going to make this a university. Something has to be decided about that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we can support all kinds of programs that are geared entirely to doing things for people outside that ask us to do specific things about, you know, like travel programs and...
Mm-hmm. A vocational
school. Yeah, vocational. Now, I don't like to use that word because, you know, I know people have to have a vocation. I'm not, you know, but a university has to transcend that level of operation, and it has to persuade the public to support it to do that. That's a political problem as much as it is an intellectual problem, I think. Mm-hmm. And I would hate to see the day come when only a few private institutions have this responsibility, because I don't think they do as good a job in many ways as public universities do. Mm-hmm. So that's what I celebrate the fact that I've been here while Michigan State became what it is now. And I think my career kind of spanned the crucial period in its growth, not to take anything away from the first 100 years, but mm-hmm. the last 50 years have been something really special in many ways, or the first 25 years of the last 50 years. Once that was over, then it remained to be, how are we going to continue now, you know? You can't keep inventing yourself every year. You've got to somehow live with what you are, and I think that's where we are at this moment. I don't see much discourse on that subject these days. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I'm retired, and I know that, and so forth. Maybe there is discourse on it, but I don't think so. And I think that whatever discourse there is about the future of this place is focused on who can we please next.
Well, I want to thank you for the time that you've spent and sharing your ideas with us and contributing to the Oral History Project.
Hope it amounts to something, and I never know how interviews come out.
It's hard to make them in.
They sound good when you're talking sometimes, but you never know how it all goes together.
I want to thank you, and I appreciate your time.
Well, I'm glad to help out in any way, and I take it we can someday see all these in the archives. I'd
Absolutely.
Be interested. Are you going to interview Milder? You should do that.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody already has.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. Is there anybody else that you can think of that maybe should be either a former student or...
Fred Williams?
Fred Williams?
Yeah, I'm sure that...
Obviously,
yeah,
would want to yeah, try to yeah, do that. Uh-huh. We obviously miss Paul Varg, but...
Yeah, yes.
I was his last graduate student. So.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. Oh,
you got on my degree? Committee. So my degree is here. Fred Williams
I thought
was my.
It was Fred Williams was.
He was, but Paul yeah. was. I was on Paul yeah. or Paul Varg was on my committee too. So he always asked the question I couldn't answer.
You know, if ever possible, it might be worth your time or somebody's time to talk to Jim Niblock,
okay,
who for many years was chairperson of the music department.
Okay.
And
is he still in the area?
Yeah, he still lives in the area. He can tell you a great deal about that side of the university, which really has its own story.
The performing arts? And,
yeah.
Yeah, okay. Anyone in art that you can think of?
Well, let's see. Oh, my old friends in art are somehow out of the picture.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can let me know
if you can think of anyone. Okay, yeah, let me think about that a little bit.
Okay.
You might, in English, let's see. Most of the old timers there are retired too. Dave Mead would be a good one.
Dave Bean?
Dave Mead.
Oh, Need.
Yeah, Mead. M-E-A-D.
M-E-A-D.
Yeah. Okay. And I hope somebody got Russ Nye's record down, but I doubt it.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of surprised that somebody hadn't been doing this for a long time.
Well, it's the type of thing that people talk about, yeah, think it's a good thing, but never actually do it. So I was pleased that finally they said, at least we'll get started, and then this will be an archive that will be available.
I'm sure that Fred would be open to this kind of thing, and
yeah. When I call him up, I don't think it'll be a tough sell. Again, thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet.
Mm-hmm.